Welcome to Keep You 100 Radio. I'm your host, Lissy Pointer, type 1 diabetic, certified health coach, personal trainer, and founder of Needles and Spoons Health and Wellness. Inside this podcast, you'll find the real and raw conversations around diabetes management, including the lessons that we don't learn in our endo's office, my best tips and trainings, and conversations from the experts that I trust inside the community so that you can create more predictability in your diabetes management and feel empowered while doing so. Let's dive in.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Keeping It 100 Radio. On today's episode, we are talking with Rob Howe. Rob, I'm stealing a bit of your bio from LinkedIn, so we're going to get right into all the nitty-gritty of everything that you do. Rob is an entrepreneur, an Instagrammer, and a marketing strategist. He's a former professional athlete, podcaster, audiobook junkie, and type 1 diabetic. He has 10-plus years of social media marketing experience with brands of all kinds, ranging from the United States Olympic Committee, 7-Eleven, Ace Cash Express, Discover, and we all know Medtronic Diabetes, JDRF, and so much more. You're an improv comic, a YouTuber, and a believer in good. And one thing that I had to throw in here was the CGM 69 enthusiast. I feel like that just deserves a spot in your bio.
I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah. I remember I actually was going back in my Instagram, your history on your stories, and I have like a tagged post of the 69 screenshot and tagging you.
Yeah, I love that. It's, you know, I think today we're going to talk a lot about things with diabetes that sort of are unexpected. And obviously like a type 1 diabetes diagnosis for 99% of us is something that nobody expects and kind of comes out of left field. And I think that's something in the diabetes community that has left me open for that too. Like, and the 69 blood sugars is just a great example, because that came about super organically. Like you mentioned improv comedy. I did improv comedy at Dallas Comedy House for almost 8 years, teaching and performing. And so I had a couple of friends with diabetes who are some of my closest friends, who we would always make jokes with each other when we got 69 blood sugars on our glucometers. And I was on a panel at a JDRF summit, and somebody asked me what my favorite thing about the diabetes online community was. And I said, when people tag me in their 69 blood sugars. And that day, one of the other panelists had a 69 blood sugar and tagged me, and it kind of started from there. And I think it's hard to count, but I would say probably 2,500 or more people over the years have tagged me in their 69 blood sugars. And my favorite thing is when somebody who doesn't know me gets one and they like share it with a friend, and their friend's like, oh, you should tag this guy. And then they're like, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm tagging Rob Howe. And it's like, oh my gosh, like this is the power of the internet.
It really is. It's part of the brand now, I feel like.
Absolutely. It absolutely is.
All right. So we had the formal bio. Kind of fill us in on, who is Rob Howe outside of LinkedIn?
Yeah. So I'm glad that my LinkedIn bio is pretty up to date. And like you said, I like to do all the things. And I think that initially Diabetics Doing Things was a working title, but it stuck because I think it really does embody me and the way that I like to live my life, but also just all the different elements of being a person with diabetes. I think it's really hard to, diabetes is not a monolith. It's really hard to kind of keep us all in a box. We all do amazing things, whether we are, like yourself, helping people to, get the time and range and the control and the life that they want to live, or you're doing amazing like physical feats, like some of the people who've been on the podcast over the years. And so for me, I'm a guy who likes both. I was on a panel recently and somebody asked, a question about my diabetes management. And I thought, like, inside of me, there are two Robs. One is like super driven type A, professional athlete, entrepreneur. And on the other side, there's this sort of like silly 69 blood sugar, like goofy person. And like finding the balance between the two, both personally and professionally, is kind of what gets me up and gets me going every day. So, in my day job, I have an agency, an ad agency, Recreation Dallas. We're about to be 7 years old. I started with my partner, 7 years ago. And we do a really cool work for some really big brands and some really creative stuff, social media content, advertising campaigns, all the way up to like big TV spots. And then we have Diabetics Doing Things, which started off as just the podcast. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the origin story and stuff about that today. But this year we did 4 events. We worked with you at Skin Grip on a couple of them. Diabetes Legends Basketball Clinic. We did the Diabetics Doing Things Pickleball Classic. We entered the Diabetes Center Burn Innovation Challenge. And, we really dug in this year and focused on what our mission and vision is. And, while our mission is working with people with diabetes and creators with diabetes on content, inspiration, and events, our vision is to create a more equitable world for people with diabetes. And so, that is something that I think really powers me, is sort of the ethos for what I want to do at Diabetics Doing Things, which is, it's unfair out there for people with diabetes in a lot of different ways, not just in the US, but also globally. And, what can we do as Diabetics Doing Things, as a diabetes creator-led organization to help people, you know, not burn out, help people do what they want to do, and really kind of reinforce what we know is true about diabetes, that if you, you know, learn to take care of yourself and if you have the resources, that it doesn't have to stop you from living the life that you want, but also address those really critical needs and like kind of baseline, like Maslow's hierarchy of, you know, food and shelter and insurance coverage and enough money to live. If we can take care of those things, like what amazing things are possible from people with diabetes. So that's maybe an oversimplification, but that's what gets me up every day.
I love that so much. And I think it's really important to talk about that too, because I think that was something that was hard for me to see kind of in the beginning. I was diagnosed when I was 19, so like early adulthood. And, you know, you're kind of stuck in this mentality of these are things I have to do. I have to wear my insulin pump. I have to wear my CGM. I have to see my endocrinologist. But then when you look at big picture, it's such a privilege to have access to those things and that information. So I'm really glad that that's kind of the foundation of what you're doing with Diabetics Doing Things to make, you know, life with diabetes more equitable. So I really appreciate that.
I appreciate you saying that. It took me a while to learn too. And I think we're going to talk a lot about like when, like deciding to join the diabetes community. And I listened to your interview with Ariana, and she talked about, you know, just searching hashtag, just wondering if there are people out there sharing their life with diabetes. And I was very similar. And I just thought everybody had the same diagnosis experience that I had. And I didn't realize until I've done, you know, over almost 400 interviews now with people with diabetes and then on podcasts like yours, everybody, it runs the gamut. I had like a top 1% amazing diagnosis experience. My care team kept me in the hospital for a few days. They talked about, you know, how I was going to manage it. They taught me all the little elements. And certainly they sent me on my way, and I definitely didn't learn it all right away. But the foundation of it was that, hey, this is possible. That just because this disease is, you're going to have to manage it every day. There's no cure in sight. You're going to have to do these individual things. On the other side of that is the life that you want. And that set me up for success long term. And until I met other people, I didn't realize that not everybody gets that experience. And so that's, you know, if you take nothing else from today's episode with me, is diabetes is tough. And it's a huge adjustment, especially if you're like a young person or a parent of a really young person with diabetes. But, you know, like you said, when you were 19, like, you know, 19 is a terrible time to get diagnosed with diabetes, because you basically learned how to live one way. And then you have to learn completely immediately as soon as you get on your own how to live another way. And so, but you can do it. And, you know, I think I have, my wife and I joke a lot about, I joke that like sickness is a mindset. It's like a bit that I do, because it's obviously not, but like so much of diabetes is how you approach it. And if is one of my favorite poems by Rudyard Kipling. It's like, if you can take all this negative stuff that diabetes gives you, then on the other side of that is the whole world opens up. And so I would just want people to be encouraged by that. And, you know, no matter where you are in the world or where you are in your diabetes management, I think it's a time that you can be hopeful if you find, you know, the community.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I think it's something that's really hard to see in the beginning. And then when you're on the other side, you're like, how did I ever see it any other way? But I kind of want to backtrack just a little bit. Can you walk us through your diagnosis journey a little bit for anybody who may not have heard that before?
For sure. So pretty similar to everybody else's. But, you know, at the time, when it happens to you, you have no idea about that, right? So I was 16. It was the middle of basketball season. And I was feeling fatigued. I was losing weight. But I was also watching TV at the time, watching basketball. And because that's like my favorite thing. And the announcers on one of the games were talking about a player, and they're like, oh yeah, he's losing weight. He's rounding himself into shape at the beginning of the season. And so I just thought that was happening. So I was like, oh yeah, I'm just getting in shape. This is fine. And then New Year's Eve, I went out to like a school event. You know, we went to like an ice rink or something. It was kind of like a lock-in type situation. And I remember going to the bathroom so many times that I started to keep count. And I peed, I think, 27 times that night in like a period of like 4 hours. But I was also crushing water. And I was an athlete at the time. And I remember my coaches were like, yeah, don't drink soft drinks. I don't drink Gatorade, drink water. And I was like, oh, my coaches are going to be so psyched. I'm just crushing water right now. Little did I know, I was, you know, probably in DKA. I didn't have ketones when they checked me in the hospital, but, you know, my blood sugars were in the 400s. And the next morning I woke up and I was nauseous and kind of threw up, and my mom looked at me and she's like, something's wrong with you. We got to go to the urgent care. And my mom kind of has a sixth sense about that stuff anyway, but that's another podcast, I'm sure. But we went in there and they tested my blood. They heard my symptoms. I lost about 20 pounds in 2 weeks at the time. You know, I was about 6'5", 175. So to lose 20 pounds from that frame was pretty noticeable. I was a string bean, as they would say in Texas. But you know, thirsty, frequent urination, fatigue. And they were like, hey, let's check your blood sugar. Sure enough, blood sugar was like 450. So they sent me to Children's Medical Center, Dallas. And I remember this was 2005, January 1st, 2005. And so the Postal Service was like a super popular band at the time. And it was like a rainy, overcast day. The Postal Service was on the radio. And it was just like the most big emo 16-year-old moment of all time. And I just remember wondering, is this over? Is my life as I know it over? And I didn't know the answer. And so when I got there, that was kind of like the frame of mind that I was in. It's like, I had all these dreams and plans for my life. Like, is that going to be possible? And like I mentioned earlier, my care team was really quick to say, any dream you have for your life is still within reach as long as you do these things to take care of your diabetes. And so that set me off on a good foot, but I was, you know, it was over Christmas break. I didn't get to miss any school by the time I got released from the hospital. It was like over that weekend and then school was starting. And so my parents were like, yeah, dude, you're going to school. And so I got diagnosed with diabetes and over holiday break and I didn't even miss a day of school. Classic Rob.
That's the worst, especially when you're at that age. It's like, all right, diabetes diagnosis, get to miss school. Which one do I want to? Do I want to take care?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, can I benefit from this in any way? Like, what's up?
Right. What was that initial time period like? Because 16, that's a really interesting age where you're independent enough, but you're also under your parents' roof. So what was that like, just the initial, you know, the initial journey?
Great question, actually. I'm when we look at the bell curve, you know this, we look at the bell curve of A1C, your teen years are always the toughest. So if parents listen out there, it does get better. It's true for everybody. Just normalize it. I was lucky because I was kind of past my first like real hormonal angsty teen, like hate my parents years. And my parents had a lot of trust in me. I was pretty independent, driving my brother and sister around. Some weird circumstances. I got my driver's license a year early to help my brother and sister around town. And like so I was pretty independent already. And my mom is ultra type A. Her will is like is the thing I got most from her. And without that, you know, I wouldn't be on this podcast today probably. And so she and I worked together. When I was younger, it's weird. I don't think I've ever said this on an interview, but she and I were like study partners for this. It was basically Bible quiz. And I was one of the top Bible quizzers in the world. Super strange. Anyway, she and I worked together for hours every day on like studying. So we had this like really good teacher student like partnership. And we applied that to diabetes and she and I just learned to manage it together. And what was interesting to me is like I'm a like legendary rule follower. If you give me structure, and like, that's why I was a good athlete. Like you give me structure, you tell me what to do and like, I'll do it. I was valedictorian in my high school basically because I'm a rule follower. So diabetes kind of resonated with me and they were like, hey, do this and let us know how it goes. I went to my endo appointments every 3 months. I'm still friends with my pediatric endo today. He came to our pickleball tournament last weekend. Okay. You never know when your pediatric endo will just become your like lifelong friend. So, you know, that's potentially out there for you as well if you're listening, but it was going well. I was active. I was exercising. I was counting my carbs. I was, you know, eating the same thing, typically the same amount of carbs, like every, you know, at the same time every day and like following those steps. And because I think, again, I wanted what was on the other side of that. I wanted to go play college basketball. I wanted to go, you know, have a chance to play professionally. And at the time, Adam Morrison was National Player of the Year at Gonzaga playing basketball, and his diabetes was in sort of the news zeitgeist at the time. So I knew that there was somebody out there who was doing it. And so we kind of tried to adapt as much as we could learn from, you know, there was no social media at the time. So, you know, if this happened today, I'd probably just like message him and see what they did, right? Which is an awesome thing about, you know, social media today. But listening to these like ESPN reports about how his mom tested his blood sugar when he came out of the game, like, and we tried to adapt that for ourselves as well. So, but I will say, I'm kind of rambling here. And so I apologize to your listeners, but really key thing happened. I just realized recently, I was trying to get recruited to play college basketball. When you do that, you got to go to these camps. So you got to go, you know, sleepaway camps and all these trips to go play in front of coaches. And I had two camps already on the schedule that year that I had committed to. And my parents let me go. They could have been like, it would have been really normal and rational for them to say, hey, Rob, like this is new. We don't want to, you know, put you in any danger. We don't know how this is going to go. Let's skip these. But they knew what I wanted and they trusted me. And so what we learned early was to communicate. You know, they said you could do anything. So we're like, all right, let's put that to the test. Let's have conversations with the camp directors. Let's have conversations with the trainers and say, hey, Rob's got diabetes. He's going to come and he's going to manage it. But here's some things to look out for. And looking back on that, that was such a key decision that they made. And I don't think they realized like what a overflow, like momentum that would build in my life with diabetes, especially because now, you know, it affects the way you make all of those decisions. I can do this versus I can't do this, or I can do this versus I shouldn't do this. And I didn't know at the time, but they really set me up for success long term by letting me do those things.
The subconscious is so powerful. Like the things that you hear, I mean, we hear about it a lot when we are children. Like the most forming ages, I think, are between 2 and 7. But I kind of look at that in terms of our diabetes diagnosis, that those are the T frames that we take into our life with diabetes. So if you're hearing that from the very beginning of like, you can manage this, you can do this, you're going to take that with you long term. So I really love that approach. And how did the camp go? How did that all turn out?
It went great. I think I learned also like the power of exercise. And like, I feel like I didn't take any boluses the whole week because I was just playing basketball all the time. And like my sugars were pretty stable. I drank a lot of Gatorade, a lot of snacks to keep my blood sugar up. And that just sort of became, you know, there were no CGMs, or they weren't widely used at the time. So, you know, it was a lot of just testing my blood sugar on my own. A lot of like, okay, well, do I need to inject for this or not? You know, I would come out of the games after like a morning workout and my sugars would be, you know, within range. And I was like, okay, well, I know I'm going to come down after playing, so I'm just going to eat this and see how it goes. And I remember kind of laughing with my parents later of being like, wow, like when I go to basketball camp or when I'm playing basketball most of the day, at the time I was on multiple daily injections. So I had like the basal insulin on board. I take less basal insulin and I also don't even have to bolus for meals. And that was weird, but like it kind of gave me an insight into how my body responds to exercise and how, you know, hydration plays a point in that or a part in that as well. But they went great. I didn't end up going to Duke or to Baylor, but that was because I wasn't good enough, not because of my diabetes.
No, I love that so much. It reminds me too, in the first year of my diagnosis, well, first of all, my advisors were telling me, take the semester off. And for me, that was not an option. So, I mean, I know that you were said that you missed school. I did not want to miss it. It was my first year at college. And what was it? I got diagnosed in February. In May, I went to Curacao for a research trip. And that was, I think it's interesting hearing you talk about your journey and like you were learning trends of like, what does my blood sugar do while I'm playing basketball? In my experience, I was so naive to that. I was just doing what my doctors told me to do, take this many units for this much food. Then I'm traveling on this research trip and we're doing a lot of walking, a lot of snorkeling. And I was so surprised when my blood sugar would go down to like 50. So it's really interesting hearing you talk about like, I know, you know, I learned my trends kind of early on. I was doing the work. So I think that's really cool to have more information.
I credit it with being an athlete, I think, because I had this coach maybe 2 or 3, he was later in my high school career, but he explained to me the first time, like, listen to your body. And I think diabetes for me gave me a much more intuitive look at what's happening inside my body, like what food does to me, what drinks do to me, like what sleep does to me. And I tried to look at it like without judgment. I think looking back, it sounds like I was like super mature and like really buttoned up about it. But I think I was just curious because I was learning every day. Like, oh, I remember one time I left my insulin pen. We went off campus for lunch when I was a senior in high school. And I left my pen at school. And so I was like, oh, like, I don't know what to do about this. Like, okay, I'll eat and then I'll get back to school. I'll test my blood sugar and like adjust based on what my blood sugar is. And I was like panicked about it. Like, I was like, oh no, this has never happened before. What do I do? And I ate probably 90 carbs of like food. And this is probably still like honeymooning as well, but I got back and my blood sugar like never came above like 140. I'm like, what happened here? Like, what did I learn from this? And, you know, not having the CGM graph, I'm sure that I was like a little bit low going into it, maybe had some insulin sensitivity from like, you know, being active that day or something. And one reason or another, we could, you know, guess all day, but I didn't give an injection there. I'm like, well, what is this all about? Like, you know, and I think that curiosity is something that's really important for people with diabetes because you never know what's going to happen. And I think especially for women, you talk a lot about this, you know, tracking your hormones and, you know, the part of the point of your cycle that you're in. When I learned that women with diabetes had to manage that, I was like, wow, what a cheat code to not have to worry about that because it's so complicated and there's so many inputs. And so again, just to normalize that diabetes throws curveballs in so many different ways. And you never know what you're going to learn. So I try to like, I don't give a lot of advice to people, but when they really dig in and ask, I just say, have a little bit of curiosity, you know, stop holding on so tight to the judgment and just wonder what's happening. Yeah. Listen to your body.
Absolutely. I love that. And I think that's where a lot of frustration comes from, because it's not textbook. You know, with every other diagnosis, I live with Crohn's as well. So every day I wake up, I take my four pills that I have to take, and, you know, we're good for the most part, you know, aside for if I have any flares that, you know, come up. And with diabetes, it's so different. And I think that you can either use that to get curious, or you can use that to get frustrated. And that's kind of the difference that we're talking about with mindset. But I want to kind of backtrack a little bit. So you had mentioned that you had one kind of major influence when you were first diagnosed that was also playing basketball. He's living with diabetes. Was that the only influence that you were kind of looking at that time? Or did you see other people with diabetes? Did you know other people with diabetes?
So at the time, not really. I think having a public figure, and, you know, this is sort of getting into the origin story of diabetics doing things, like seeing Adam and like on TV at the highest level doing what I wanted to do with diabetes, let me know, like, A, that it's possible, that if I don't make it, it's not because of the diabetes. And, you know, that was kind of the fuel that I needed. I did have, there was a friend, my friend Kendall. It's funny, his name's Kendall Goshorn, which is also the sweet librarian's name, Kendall Kidder Goshorn. So he had diabetes. We've laughed about that over the years. So Kendall had type 1 diabetes. And I wouldn't say that, like, he, you know, I knew that he had been to the hospital a couple of times. I didn't really know anything about his management. So I remember going to lunch with him, and he was a few years older than me, and we were friends and, you know, knew each other in a couple of different capacities. And he kind of explained it, but I didn't have anybody in my immediate circle that I was looking to as like a diabetes mentor or guide. I was kind of, again, my mom and I were listening to the doctors, following the rules, and kind of exploring it on our own. And it wasn't until like 10 years later where I learned about the power of the community. And now we know, like, clinical outcomes improve when you connect with other people with diabetes. I say a friend with diabetes is a friend indeed. And, you know, you can see on my chart of my A1Cs over my life, and A1C is not everything, but since I've made friends with diabetes, my A1Cs have been in better control than when I wasn't. And there's research that suggests it's almost 100% of the time when you are involved with diabetes social media, diabetes blogs, and diabetes friends, friendships, your clinical outcomes improve almost 100% of the time. So I would encourage people, if you don't have a friend with diabetes, make one. You know, there's two here you could reach out to. And I think that was one of the things when I spoke to our campers at Diabetes Legends. I was like, your goal today, we're going to play basketball. You're going to meet Gary Forbes. And I'll get to the rest of your question here in a second. But I want you to make a friend with diabetes today. You leave here with a friend, and I put it on their parents too. I was like, there's parents in the stands, people just like you. Don't leave here without making a friend. Because just those conversations, you know how it is. When you're able to talk to somebody, you're able to skip so much explanation, so much exposition, and get right to the core of it and hear real stories and real advice. So my junior year of college, though, I was kind of struggling to get playing time. My college coach and I are very different people and had very different ideas of how things should be done. And I was kind of trying to decide whether I was either going to transfer or whether I was going to quit, you know, and I didn't really know. And I saw this article in the Denver Post about a guy playing for the Nuggets named Gary Forbes. And he lived with type 1 diabetes. And so there's a little kind of snippet. And I saw, hey, here's another guy in the NBA doing the thing that I want to do. And he's only 50 miles up the street. I was living in Colorado Springs at the time, and that's where I went to school. And I was like, man, there's a guy here in this immediate network. So I kind of just noted that name and just kind of stored it in my brain. And, you know, shout out to today, you know, Gary and I are friends, like good friends. And he came to our camp in Denver, and we talk all the time. And, you know, getting to tell him that, like, I didn't quit because I saw he shared his story in the paper. I mean, that's a small, like, obviously, like, he was in the NBA sharing a story in the paper. Not everybody's story makes the paper and all that stuff. But I would encourage people that if you just open yourself up and be vulnerable to say, I have diabetes and whatever, and it's hard, and I do this, and I still am living the life I want, whatever the case may be, someone may see that and store your name or your story in their brain. And one day it may help them do something completely different. Because, you know, if I don't see that, and I do quit, then I don't have that professional athlete denotation. That's a big part of my identity and my story with diabetes, especially. So I don't know. I think that sharing your story and being vulnerable really matters. You never know who might see that and get inspired, and 10 years later, do a basketball clinic that invites you out to impact other people. So I don't know. I think that's a big part of my story in terms of, it took me about 10 years to get comfortable sharing my life with diabetes. I did the puff piece. There's a newspaper article from high school that says, no stopping him. You know, there's a There's the student newspaper at my college talking about my diabetes journey. But I was like focused on being a basketball player and like kind of, you know, getting through college. I wasn't really as much focused on advocacy at the time. And it took me 10 years. And now over the past 8 years, my whole life has changed. And I've met people like yourself and other, and, you know, thousands of people all over the world who relate to me and what we're doing. And so I don't know if you're listening to this and you haven't raised your hand and said, hey, I have diabetes, I want to connect with people, I would highly encourage you to do that.
I love that so much, because going back to what you mentioned about like you weren't focusing on doing advocacy, sometimes you don't realize that just by doing the things that you love with diabetes is advocating. And I think I'd been looking at your Instagram and you had done a post kind of like, what does diabetes advocacy look like? I think it was around Diabetes Awareness Day. And I think it can look like so many different things, like kind of similar to what you were saying with Gary, like you never really realized that you would be close with him, be a friend. This is on a much lower level, but, you know, people from high school or from my high school are being diagnosed with diabetes right now. And, you know, I've been living with it for about 10 years. All I'm doing is showing up online and talking about it. But now I have people that I was never friends with or never really even had connections with. They're reaching out and saying, you know, I was just diagnosed. I know that you're talking about it. We weren't close before, but I just need somebody to connect with and be friends with about it. And I just love that way of approaching it so much of like, it's an instant connection. And honestly, some of my closest friends now are just people that I've met on the online space just because they live with diabetes. Amanda Siprich, T1D nutritionist. We met through on Instagram, found out that we were 20 minutes away from each other. And now she's one of my best friends. It's just, it can bring you such amazing connections, even outside of the diabetes component. Yeah, it's, you know, it's great to have somebody to walk through this bolus with or complain about the high blood sugars with. But outside of that, it's just bringing genuine people into your life. So I think it's really important to talk about. I say this all the time, but when I was first diagnosed, same thing. Social media wasn't really a thing, but, not like it is now with influencers and being able to just search diabetes and a whole bunch of creators come up. But I had searched type 1 diabetes and the only person to come up was Nick Jonas. And I mean, maybe other people can, but I can't really relate to him because I'm not a pop star. So I think it's just...
Wait, you're not? Power.
I mean, maybe I'm like Hannah Montana and just throw on a wig. But yeah, it's so powerful. So at what point did you... Like, obviously, you had those articles written about you in high school, but you were focusing on basketball. At what point did you intentionally start sharing your story through social media or other outlets?
Yeah, so I've told this story before, and it's really the origin story of Diabetics Doing Things. I got the opportunity. I'll tell it a different way this time because I don't want the same story to be all out there all over the place. So improv comedy came into my life in 2013. I just stumbled into Dallas Comedy House. I made one Google search and I met some of my best friends doing that. A fundamental component of improv, basically the core principle, is saying yes and then adding yes and is the principle. So I was working at an agency. That's where I met my wife. We had these like guys through who were from Colombia and Nicaragua. And they were part of a government program called the International Center for Journalists, which takes journalists and communication employees and professionals from Middle East and South and Central America, and they bring them over to the US. And occasionally there's an exchange program. So it was a Memorial Day weekend. I knew we had Monday off. These guys didn't have cars. Uber wasn't as popular at the time. And I was like, hey, what are you guys doing on Monday? And they were like, oh, I don't know, we don't have any plans. So I was like, okay, well, I'm going to pick you up. We'll go around town. So I took him around. We just did some like classic Dallas kind of touristy stuff and had a good day. And I didn't think anything of it. Well, after they went back to their respective countries and like through the program, they mentioned that I had like gone out of my way to hang out with them. And again, I had no idea that this was happening. And so I got an email from the International Center for Journalists and they say, hey, occasionally we ask people from the companies to go back to visit their you know, cohorts in their home country. So we'd like you to go to Colombia for 2 weeks. So I was like, oh my God. At the time, it was 2015. I was, 27. Things were going good in my career. 26, maybe. I don't remember. And I had just met, my wife, or, she's now my wife. Then we were just kind of casually dating. And I was having this conversation with my parents. I was like, my career is going good. My personal life's going good, but like something missing. And my dad reminded me of something when I was a kid, like National Honor Society. I don't know. I'm a super nerd rule follower, but you have to like volunteer. And when I was working on like, where do I want to volunteer? My dad was like, well, you always seem happiest when you're helping people. So I remembered that conversation. And so I'm sitting here in my hotel room in Colombia because the trip insurance wouldn't allow me to leave the hotel on my own after a certain time without a translator. Because I don't know, big city, you know, language barrier. I stand out like a sore thumb in Central America. It was probably smart. So I knew that I was going to have all this time to like think. And so I'm in this room. I'm like, okay, you're always happiest when you're helping people, but who can I help? There's so many people that need help. Where do I start? And just at that moment, I'm sitting in a big reclining chair and my insulin pump, I wear a tube pump Medtronic, like you said, came falling out and clattered on the floor. And I was, you know, some people may call that a sign, but I was like, okay, well, maybe my story could help someone with diabetes. So are there, I was into, you know, marketing and social media and content. I was like, are there diabetes bloggers? Sure, there are. I found some. Are there diabetes content creators? Not as many at the time. And this was kind of all at the time where the diabetes online community really was gaining traction on Instagram. Probably a couple of years after you were diagnosed, it sounds like. So yeah, I just decided like, all right, well, I'm going to do a podcast because I just listened to Serial because I knew that if I decided to write a blog, that was a great way for me to write exactly zero blogs. And I was like, I'll do 10 episodes. If somebody says this helped them, then I'll keep doing it. And man, in those first 10 episodes, we're going to revisit some of the people who were on in those first 10 because I've run into them and talked to them and became, you know, maintained friendships with them over the years. But we reached a lot of people and the stories really connected. And I felt like, oh man, like maybe I found a community of people who really know what's going on. And I was just curious. I wanted to tell stories and I felt like in those first 10 episodes, I think it was episode 3, like 4 or 5 people said, man, this was a really good episode. I really like this. And I was like, okay, well now I have to keep doing it. And so that was 8 years ago and we're still doing it. We've published over 300 episodes on the feed with Diabetics Doing Things and with Tools of Type 1, which was a series I did in 2019. I've been on probably 50 or so other podcasts like this over the years, met so many people, spoken all over the world. Our company has evolved. It's small, but we reached a lot of people. You know, we did 120 reels this year of podcast episodes. Like we're, you know, basically a full-blown media company. And all that came from, oh, I wonder if my story could help somebody with diabetes. And obviously I'm biased, but my favorite stories to talk about are when parents or kids who are trying to play basketball talk to me. I get to meet my other diabetes hoopers all over the world. And like, we instantly have like, you know, when you have two things like that in common with someone, there's just, you get to skip a lot of exposition and really connect. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's been the great, diabetes is a dichotomy. That's a talk that I give as well. It's like the best, worst thing that ever happened to me. I wish I didn't have to worry about it, but the relationships, the purpose that it has given me, the impact that it has allowed me to uncover, I wouldn't have without it. And so, you know, back to the, you know, mindset piece, which, you know, I have to really check myself because like you said, in that advocacy post, not everybody has access. And, you know, throughout the world, there are people who have to like literally walk across minefields to get their insulin. And, you know, we don't have, you know, sometimes the Walgreens drive-through feels like a minefield, but it's definitely not. So, you know, I think for me, again, like if you can adjust your mindset to look on your diabetes without judgment and not take it too personally, I think, you know, the relationships and the adventures that you can have as a result, I would have a hard time trading for sure.
Absolutely. I think about that all the time of if there was a cure tomorrow, what would I do? Obviously, that would be amazing for overall health, longevity, not having to worry about everything that you put in your mouth. Beautiful. But at the same time,
I'm sorry to cut you off. Go ahead. That's a bad habit I have.
It's okay. It's okay. At the same time, there's been so many beautiful things that have stemmed from this, like the connections that we make, the opportunities that have come from it, just the things that you learn about yourself and your body and your health and how you grow. So I love that you mentioned that. I want to give you a space to pop in.
Well, this is keeping it 100, right? So I agree with you. I mean, the experiences that I have, the friendships that I've made, at the same time, I would love to go to conferences every year of like the former diabetes conferences, you know, people who formerly were the artists formerly known as diabetics. I would love that. So I do have a question for you though, because now there's like people in clinical trials who have been cured of their diabetes, but they take immunosuppressants. So the question now is like, would you trade your daily management and your understanding of management of diabetes for immunosuppressants on a daily basis? Do you think? And I don't know the answer. I think it's a deeply personal thing, but that's something that is like already happening. What do you think?
That's a great question. I think for me, I would say no. And the reason being, yes, the daily management sucks, to say the least. But at the same time, I use it as such a biomarker for what's going on with my body. It just lets me know so much. Am I more stressed? Am I sick? Am I at a certain point in my cycle? And to me, that's a huge, it makes a huge influence in my life. With immunosuppressants, I don't know if I would want to trade off how careful I'm living. To me, I would just rather continue with the day-to-day management.
That's a great answer. I feel very similar. I have not had the chance yet to do it. I was very lucky. I got to be in a small group. Aaron Kowalski, the CEO of JDRF, came to Dallas, and I'm on the JDRF Dallas board. And I got to go be one of, 25 people in this room where he was kind of talking about, the advancements in research. And he was even pretty honest about, I have the chance. I could go take an immunosuppressants, and I'm not doing it. So certainly there's a big barrier. I think I'm a quotes and cliches guy. So like the devil you know versus the devil you don't, right? I know the devil of diabetes. I've woken up with it every day for the past, almost 20 years. And, I go back to that question that I had for my care team right at diagnosis, is this going to change my idea of my life? And I know that I can live with diabetes. I don't know that I can live with immunosuppressants. Now, the answer may be yes. I'm still going to have to wear a CGM because I'm going to have to see if it's working, So it's like, what are the real trade-offs here? And so I don't know. I think it's interesting because, there's all the cure discussion, right? When you're first diagnosed, you're like, 5 years, 10 years, it'll be fine. And we've all been hearing that for so long. And now we're kind of on the cusp of it. And now the bigger question for me is all right, well, what does it cost? Who's going to be able to get this? And, that's the real, if you really want to get into a rabbit hole, that's the challenge, right? It's that in the United States, we have for-profit healthcare and, just pretty much proving all the time that doesn't work. So anyway, before we get too off topic, I thought that would be interesting of there is a chance for you to not have diabetes anymore, even though it's temporary because you got to take the immunosuppressants, but that's going to be a decision that people are making actively here in the next few years.
Yeah, it will be very interesting to see how that goes. And we're even kind of seeing, with automated pumps, the separation between diabetes and self. And that kind of leads me into my next question. And I didn't put this in our email, so I'm kind of interested to hear your thoughts about it. But obviously, you've been living with diabetes for a while now. You work very heavily in the diabetes community. You're posting about diabetes. You are running events. You're part of boards. How has that influenced how much of your identity diabetes plays a part of?
Diabetes is part of my identity. It's not my whole self. I'm not very interested in it, to be honest with you, which sounds really callous and kind of like, of course I am. I just nerded out about research. I care about people with diabetes. I want people with diabetes to be free. I want them to live without boundaries. I don't know. But at the same time, it's just inputs and outputs to me. It's certainly not my whole personality. I think that's one of the reasons why people kind of like my diabetes vibe is that it really isn't. It doesn't run my life. It doesn't have me. I have it. I've been hard to kill since 1988. That's my kind of thing I've been joking around with lately. And I think I carry it as a badge of honor. And when I'm cooking somebody on the basketball court, or they don't know that I have an insulin pump and I've been bouncing my blood sugars in my brain for the last 19 years. They didn't wake up in the middle of the night and treat a little blood sugar. They didn't, have to explain on a first date what they were doing. And still we get to do the fun things. We get to have the freedom, and we get to live the life that we want. I think what I do lately, and I think I'm just getting older, is I really try to, I'm real quick to react on days where things don't go well, where there's an occluded site, or where there's a prior authorization required for my insurance, or a supply order is delayed, or a sensor fails. I ball up my fists and I'm like, wow, this sucks. But on the days where everything does go really well and it is working right, I have to remember. And now I'm being much more aware to celebrate those as well. And early on in my speaking career, I met this family who their son was 19. He was really struggling with his acceptance of his diabetes, and he had two really bad lows the previous week, and they had to call the ambulance. So they're like, we had the ambulance come 2 out of 7 days last week. And I asked them, back to the mindset thing, I was like, well, that's still the minority of the days last week. You woke up 5 days without the ambulance. Did you celebrate that? Did you notice that? And they were like, no. And it's like, okay, well, not every day is going to be an ambulance day. He's still, and also I think, the acceptance, everybody comes into it when they're ready on their own time. You cannot force someone to, even me, like I think I'm pretty cool. I'm starting to get older. So we're like, the young kids are like, this guy's old, this guy's washed. He's mid, as the Gen Zers would say. But you can't, just because I am cool and living a cool life, and you might have a 16-year-old son or daughter who's like, you know, kind of resisting you, like they probably are not gonna like me right away either, because they're not ready. And this is a hard thing to accept. And maybe I would love to hear your perspective on this too, but like getting diagnosed at 19, getting diagnosed at 16, we kind of had at least an idea of who we are already, but diabetes really forces you to grow up quickly. All of a sudden you're responsible for your own mortality, and you might be 4 years old, and that changes you as a person. And I think when I look at people who are burned out, or, and I meet people who are really cynical, it's because they've been dealing with this sort of looming threat of maybe not having enough gummy bears and dying, you know, and like how silly that is, you know, like you're where, oh my gosh, I have to get some Sour Patch Kids or else I'm going to have to call the ambulance. Or, oh man, I ate too many chips at this Mexican restaurant because I wasn't really paying too much attention. And now I got to go to the hospital because I'm in DKA. You know, these are things like that from an early age, many people deal with. So I love your perspective on that too, because I think diabetes is a part of me and I can't change that, and I wouldn't change it at this point, but it's not every part of who I am.
I love that response. And I think it's definitely twofold. So there's the part where it absolutely plays a role into everything that you do. So similar to yourself, like when you're playing basketball and you're like, you know, they don't know that I woke up from a low last night. They don't know that I just had to check my blood sugar. I kind of use that. Some people always ask me like, I'm a short 5'2" petite, you know, female, and people always ask me like, when you go to the gym, how do you go in confidently? Like I'm in the weight section, and I'm like, because I have it in my mentality that people are thinking she has an insulin pump on her arm, good for her, she's lifting heavy, she's, you know, just, I have that mentality that they're so impressed. Even people are not paying attention to you, but I'm like, they're impressed because I live with diabetes and I'm doing this. That way of showing that it's a part of everything that you do. Now, on the other hand, one thing that I really love about your social accounts, and just so you're like a jack of all trades, right? Like you do so many things. You're very active in different sports and different organizations, and you're an entrepreneur. One thing that I really appreciate that is that you're highlighting those things outside of diabetes. And I think that's something, just in being a content creator, I've struggled with, of not just showing diabetes. So like I have a private Instagram account, and it's very private. I just show my family. I just show like my relationship, that's kind of it. And then my diabetes account, I show diabetes. And I think seeing accounts like yours, I'm challenging myself to, you know, what else is there? What else do I want to show that is personal to me, that makes me me outside of diabetes? And that's a hard question to ask when you are so involved in the diabetes space. So I think that's something I'm still working through. And I don't know if that just comes from living with diabetes or being a creator. I don't know. But yeah, definitely a twofold.
You know, there are people like us who live with diabetes, who work in diabetes, who give of themselves to create content around diabetes, or diabetes creators, entrepreneurs, whatever the case. And, you know, even still, like, I'm not sure if you've had this experience, but like working with, you know, when you're a creator and like you get what you want, which is, you know, brands to notice you and maybe pay you for your work. Now, all of a sudden, somebody else has to approve what you post. And it's got to be on label, and it's got to be, you may not have as much freedom. So something I struggled with really, in a couple of my engagements over the, you know, about a year ago, there was some different legal things that were going on at some of the companies I was working with, and it prevented me from basically sharing anything candid about diabetes. And I was like, well, I didn't even know I was getting into this, and it made me really upset, and I was kind of a pain to deal with. So if any of those people are listening, I'm sorry, but I've already apologized. It's good. But I don't have enough capacity to have two Instagram accounts. I'm just too dumb. So I was like, you know, just I can't segment them. And I think early on, two people asked me like, well, are you going to create a diabetes account? And I said, no, because I think I think people do that because they're like, oh, I don't want to make my friends and family uncomfortable with how much diabetes I share. But I didn't think about that because like, I'm not oversharing. I'm just sharing the amount that I'm thinking about it all the time anyway. And I think sharing that burden and letting people who don't have diabetes know how much I'm thinking about it really does help normalize what's going on. At Diabetes Legends, you know, something occurred to me because we had probably 15 kids throughout the clinic like step out and get a juice box or, you know, have a little gummy snack and check their blood sugar. And it was really special because like everybody in the gym had diabetes, so it was super normal. And I was looking at the parents whenever a kid who wasn't their kid came out of the game to test or to treat their lows. And I just saw like a collective sigh of relief every time, because so often we're the only person in the room with diabetes, or at least with type one. You know, one in three people have diabetes. So there's a lot of pre-diabetes stuff going on, but like there's not a lot of awareness for people around that. So you're the only person actively managing your pancreas in a room. And I just think it's really important to be in rooms where that's not the case. The first time I went to a JDRF Type 1 Nation Summit, there was like 250 people there, and like beeps and alarms were going off the whole time. It just felt really weird. I had never been in a room like that. And it's so impactful. It changes your perspective. So again, like burnout comes in a lot of ways. You're going to have diabetes burnout. It happens all the time. If creating content causes burnout, I would, you know, give it a rest. You know, there's plenty of content on all these platforms that they've got us by in a stranglehold. You can take a break. And, you know, I think for me too, is like comparison is the thief of joy. And when you're looking at, you know, and for example, I'm on your podcast. Early on, people would ask me like, well, do you get threatened by other podcasts? And it's like, absolutely not. This is a community. I know some people don't feel that way. But the way I look at competition, I heard in a Terry Crews interview from 2018 on the Tim Ferriss Show, which is one of my favorite podcasts. And he was talking about competition, and he's, you know, people are quick to say it's a dog eat dog world, but dogs don't eat other dogs. So if you change your perspective, I mean, they might in a terrible, dire situation. Let's leave that out of it. But my dog will eat basically anything. But anyway, that's not a natural behavior. So why would we do that to each other? Why could we not? Aren't we trying to advocate for as many people as possible? If you feel like there's somebody who you're comparing yourself to, who's been putting it's their day 1000 and it's just your day one, or maybe you don't connect with the community the same way they do, I think that's an advantage. There needs to be a place for everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are already a small community in terms of the population of the world. We're a minority. So why not welcome as many people into that as possible? And whether you're the, you know, king or queen diabetes creator and have been for years, or you've never made a post about diabetes in your life, you're going to feel burned out. And if you have somebody that you can turn to in those moments, your life is going to be better. So yeah, I do a lot of stuff. I'm chronically busy. My wife and I joke, I'm a real sicko. I wake up early in the morning, I jump in the cold water, and I like look into the sun, and I drink all the supplements and the athletic greens, and I work out, and I do all the stuff. And because I have to do that to live the life that I want. That to me is the gateway to creative and personal freedom and connecting with people that, you know, I'm open to that. I haven't met the people in my life that might be the most important people. You never know. And I think if you're open to that possibility and you let yourself have the capacity to say yes, and you can love yourself without judgment, even if your blood sugars are shitty. I don't know. Sorry for using language on your podcast. I don't know if you did that, but keeping it at 100. If you can love yourself when your blood sugars are low, if you can love yourself when your blood sugars are high, if you can love yourself when you snap at your partner because you've had a difficult diabetes day, then what's on the other side of that is extreme freedom with your relationship to yourself and your diabetes, because it is a part of you. And I'm not here to tell you how big of a part you need to make it. Whatever that is to you, I think is a very deeply personal decision. Just like devices, just like management, just like choosing a coaching program or not, just like the way that you manage it, we don't have to all fit the same sort of framework.
Right.
And I think for me, the more people I meet, the more surprised I am at how differently we all manage this disease and still get pretty much the same results.
I love that. That's a really good perspective, because I talk to so many people within, you know, especially within the coaching community, a lot of people talk about, you know, well, why would I share my story when other people are already doing the same, or we have kind of similar perspectives. I'm like, yes, but they're so different. I'm sure I'm not the first person in the world to take a holistic approach to diabetes. However, people might connect with me differently. I was diagnosed at 19. I was a young adult. I live in New Jersey. I wear an Omnipod and a Dexcom. Like, people have such different connections to different stories and perspectives and just personalities. So being able to share that and highlight that in whatever way feels natural and good, I think is so important. One question that I'll kind of start wrapping up with is, you know, we kind of heard some takeaways from your last statement, but, you know, what are ways that you do deal with the burnout or comparison? Or is that not really too prevalent because of your mindset?
I think any fool can learn from experience. is one of my favorite quotes. And so I try to really listen to and learn from people who've gone before me, both in diabetes and out. And so right now, my diabetes burnout is relatively low. I'm on an amazing product. For me, the MiniMed 780G system has allowed me to kind of release some of the control that I'm a very type A controlled person. And it allows me to kind of, I trust what it does. And the algorithm is very in sync with how I like to manage my diabetes. So I kind of have my alerts off, and except for, you know, extreme circumstances. And that's different for me. So that's giving me a little bit of that back. And at the same time, I think you can recognize and like feel very present in your body when something makes you upset. And so I'm trying to remove as much of that as possible. I also am very conscious. I try to like not be too curated. I want to make sure that I'm still taking in information and I'm questioning why and having curiosity around why some of these things either make me upset or make me feel a certain way. Man, a big thing for me is getting outside and touching grass, feeling sun on my face, moving my body, jumping in that cold water. Nothing will bring you present, make you present like that. And I think also, you know, there's a lot of people like yourself and me, and there's a lot of mindset discussions and a lot about being present and a lot about all these different things, but being present hurts. It's hard. You have to sit with yourself. And, you know, they say most of man's problems stem from not being able to sit with himself for 30 minutes. And, you know, we always have the phone. The phone's going to give us unlimited information. Literally everything that has ever been written in the history of mankind is right there available to us. And we don't even have to look for it. It just delivers it to us. And I think that also contributes to, you know, a lot of the things that people our age feel, and they kind of feel alone, they feel isolated. So all those things are the antidote to all those things is to be present, to connect with real people who love you and care about you. And a great way to find those people is to share your story. You never know, if you don't share, who might resonate with that story. A 21-year-old kid in Colorado Springs ready to quit basketball could read something and change his whole trajectory of his life because of something you said.
Oh, that's so good. And the phone is so, I actually was having this internal monologue this morning, you know, I have this bad habit. I will be making my breakfast and I'll just like listen to TikTok. Just like when people are sharing stories, I don't watch it, but I have it because I need some like mental stimulation. I need to just listen to something. I should listen to podcasts, but then I sit down. It's a whole thing. I challenged myself this morning. I'm like, no, I don't need that. I don't need social media up on my phone this early in the morning. I'm going to put my phone on the table and I'm just going to sit here for the next 2 minutes or 5 minutes and cook my eggs. And it sounds so silly, but it was so uncomfortable just sitting there. But to your point, it's so important because, you know, what's on the other side of those moments? Well, maybe I would miss out on opportunities to hang out with my dogs or my husband or whatever it is. And one thing, I was actually listening to your episode on, I forgot the name of it, but it was Sammy Parker's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And you're talking about like the Huberman podcast and you're listening about your cold plunges. And I brought it up to Jordan, my husband. And so last night he's taking a shower. He's like, I started slowly turning the shower head colder and colder. And I stood there for two minutes. He's like, it was so uncomfortable. But I love it. I love bringing in those different ways of pausing. And it's really important. And muting accounts that maybe even if you don't disagree with them or you don't dislike them, but if it's triggering and you don't even know why, hitting the mute button just to ease that a little bit, I think is really important.
You know, those apps are designed to keep us on them. And unfortunately, one of the things that keeps us on them is making us upset. And so I think, you know, back to, you know, taking control of your, you know, autonomic responses, just listen to your body. Man, shout out to your husband, because I'm telling you, turning that, you know, back to the real, if you're a real sicko, if you can sit on there under the shower, crank that water cold on purpose. But one of the things, you know, I'm a big Huberman head. I joke, you know, I do all this stuff. It turns out all these Stanford researchers, life extension experts, basically, if you just exercise and live like an old person, if you go for a walk, if you start your day by getting sunshine, if you drink water, if you, you know, exercise a little bit, like it turns out walking is the best exercise you could possibly do. Wow. It's like, but you know, it's too easy. You got to have all these quick fixes. You know, we live in this quick fix culture, Amazon Prime. And, you know, I think though, you just have to really ask yourself, like, is this me or is this something else? And, you know, like if it's mute someone, or, you know, heaven forbid we unfollow someone, or we just say, hey, you know what? This isn't for me. That's okay. That's part of community too. I think people, that earlier you asked about, you know, people were hesitant to share their story because they felt like all the stories have been told. Well, it's because we associate success with like millions of views or followers or, you know, being a full-time content creator or whatever the case may be, YouTube plaques. But that's not what community is about. community is about what we can share with each other to make each other better. And, you know, so for me, you know, I've had challenging conversations with people, you know, who didn't like me or didn't like what I was doing. And, you know, at first I took it really personally. And then I realized, you know, everybody's not for everyone. My wife and I joke, she's a content creator and a social strategist as well. She's had a couple of viral videos this year. And like, if you reach 1 million people, you've reached 300 murderers. So like, you know, if somebody says something mean to you, yeah, exactly. So like, you know, if you reach a lot of people, like, and somebody says something negative, that's just like a normal distribution. You've never been in a room where every single person loved you 100%, but we feel like that's how it should be. And so it's like, it's okay to not vibe with everybody. There are people with diabetes who don't like me and they don't know me, but that's okay. If we ever met, I'm sure we get along. But at the same time, we're all really quickly reacting to things and our dopamine is so fried. And that's just because of the time we live in. We, you know, we have this little computer that has literally every piece of information ever collected on it. And it's changing rapidly. And we are just, our brains are ill-suited to the pleasures of today's society. And we're all doing the best that we can. So I don't know. I kind of got a little bit off track there. But I think, like, as I think about the future and like what I'm hopeful for is just more meaningful interactions with people, more hopeful conversations about inclusivity, about addressing disparities in healthcare, reaching people who have been deemed unreachable or who have been labeled non-compliant, and just showing up for them and just saying, you know, hey, I see you. I'm trying to be there for you. You know, society, it's hard living in this world. My mom and I were talking a story about some of the work that we've done with North Texas Food Bank. We volunteered, just took our little board with our QR code to take people may have diabetes or and don't have any resources to this event where they had 20,000 cars come in through this event to get food before the Thanksgiving holiday. And those are just the people who knew about the event and had the ability to drive a car through there. And Lizzie, you know, like what does somebody who's food insecure look like? They look like you and me. Mm-hmm. They drive cars that you and I drive. They are in our neighborhoods, they're in our communities, in our apartment buildings. And some of them have diabetes. And I just want to love them and let them know that we're going to do whatever we can to, you know, to get them the information and community that we need. It has nothing to do with followers or subscribers or sponsored content. It has everything to do with these people have been left behind. And, you know, the government and the healthcare system and, you know, just the talk about burnout, you know, working multiple jobs, trying to make ends meet and manage your diabetes, having to make a decision between paying rent or your kids getting to play football or soccer and you getting your insulin or a CGM prescription filled. Like those are the decisions that people with diabetes in America are having to make every day. And I just want to do what I can to, you know, connect them with resources that can really help them.
Absolutely. And to your point of before, you know, like just working together as a community to do those things. And I think the more that you're talking about it and sharing the things that you're doing, it encourages other people to do the same. So I really, really appreciate you talking about these things and bringing more awareness to them because it's so easy, again, in the way that our country is, just kind of like overlooking it. And how sustainable is that? And how helpful is that? So I have two more questions. First one being, you know, speaking of community and interactions and, you know, engagements, what's coming for Diabetics Doing Things? Like what's on the radar for 2024? What's your vision?
Well, the vision, thanks to my team nailing me down to do it, is creating a more equitable world for people with diabetes. We're going to have a renewed focus for diabetes creators and more community resources for them, more opportunities to have impact, especially through our work with North Texas Food Bank using creators, more Diabetes Legends events. We're going to do two this year, one in Dallas and one in Denver. Those will be announced very soon. And another Diabetics Doing Things Pickleball Classic to continue to grow our impact. It was just like less than a week ago, we did our first one. It was amazing. We had about 60 people out in Dallas, Texas playing pickleball, raising money for our work with North Texas Food Bank. And we had a blast. So I think for Diabetics Doing Things, how can we continue to bring top-notch events and programming and content with a mission to help people with diabetes. It's like, you can do good and you can have a cool event. What a unique novel concept. And I really want to have that be sort of our legacy for people with diabetes is it doesn't have to be like a walk. It doesn't have nothing wrong with those. It doesn't have to be boring. It doesn't have to be clinical. It can be really fun, whether you have diabetes or not. And I think that's where, you know, going into 2024, we've got some big goals. And I'm, for the first time, not just looking at year, I'm looking at decades. I'm looking at how can we zoom out and what if we stay disciplined, stay committed, stay consistent, and how far we could go, because we're still early. It's only been 100 years since people with diabetes are even like able to live. So we're still, they're still the first person with diabetes to do X. You know, I was the first person with type 1 diabetes to play for the Washington Generals. Every day there's somebody doing something with diabetes for the first time. What an awesome opportunity that is to be great.
Oh man, I love that. We have to have our own Guinness Book of World Records, is that it? We have to have one of those. But it was really cool to hear you say like you're looking at the next, you know, 10 plus years, because as an entrepreneur, that's really hard. That's really hard to do, because honestly, I mean, like I've been through it just looking at 1 year at a time, 1 day at a time. So seeing that vision and just hearing more about it is so cool. You've heard obviously another episode of the podcast, so you might have seen this coming. But for every guest, we always ask, you know, this is TP100 Radio, Uncensored Diabetes Conversations. If you could give the audience one piece of uncensored advice, what would that be?
Don't fucking quit. Don't fucking quit. Right. You know, there's that cartoon with like the little miner guy, the coal miner guy, and he's like digging and he's like, oh, I'm going to stop. And right where he stops, like right on the other side is like a big chest of gold. I think about that guy a lot. Being an entrepreneur is hard. Most people quit. You know, whatever the numbers are, like businesses that fail in the first year. It's not because people are bad or not talented. It's because it's hard. Diabetes is hard. I wanted to quit a lot, but don't do it unless it's bad for you. And like, you know, make that judgment for yourself. But like, if you really want something, make it your entire mission to make it happen. And, you know, just organize your life. And I believe the universe conspires to give you what you want. And answer the bell every day, be specific, methodical, consistent, and just be a dog. Just be a dog. Don't get beat. You can do it.
And don't eat other dogs.
Yeah, don't eat other dogs for sure.
No, I love that. I have a poster in my room that just says, you're playing small does not serve the world. And to your point, if you give up, you can make an impact. So that's what wakes me up in the morning. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I think this was an awesome conversation, and I'm really excited to share it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for keeping it 100. This was really, really awesome.